Welcome to the Writer Access Writer Podcast, bringing you new authors in one of today's hottest fields, content marketing. Here's your host, Writer Access founder and CEO, Byron White.
Welcome back to the Writer Podcast, everyone. I'm here with Drew Neiser. Drew, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
We're going to talk about your book today, the CMO's Periodic Table. It's very exciting. What a great concept, by the way, that you came up with there. Really, really cool thinking. Or were you a scientist at any stage of your career?
That's funny. I know I do admire the periodic table, and I've gotten to know it better. But it was one of these things where after interviewing 150 CMOs, I sort of realized that this was really about mixing elements and that the masters at marketing were not following a specific formula, but customizing everywhere they went. And so sort of the periodic table fell in place after talking to all these people.
There are so many choices out there that we have with where to invest our marketing dollars. How does the book and how does the CMO's periodic table help make those decisions?
Well, it really is organized in a way that you can sort of progress from, if you will, basic elements and things like that are fundamental, whether you're a writer trying to sell a story or you're, you know, General Electric trying to sell jet engines. You have to cover these basic elements, things like setting expectations and planning and strategy. And then you can sort of work your way across the periodic table and until you get to what I call sort of noble pursuits and inert fundamentals. And these are things I think that really set marketers apart, things like marketing as service or social customer service or building community. And these are and so I always like to encourage people who are starting in marketing, start with some basics, because if you don't have a strategy, you're not going to get anywhere. But then as you start to read about other examples of how marketing, you need to understand your challenge and have a specific solution for your challenge.
I have a question for you with how you yourself distinguish between strategy and tactics and how these elements on your CMO's periodic table fit with those two wonderful, just wonderfully distinctive things.
Well, strategy is where you want to go, and tactics are how do you get there. And so when we think about strategy, I always like to start with the customer in mind. I think marketers that focus on their customer almost always do better than ones that don't. The better you know your customer, the better chance you have at success. And then it becomes thinking about the customer in terms of the tactics. How would they like to engage? How would they want to participate? And I go back to, I wrote this book because it was a way for me, the interviews were a way for me to get to know and help my customers, flat out. That was it. I wanted to help them. I interviewed them. I wrote about them. The book is a result of that, and it's been helpful for our business. So the strategy in that case was to get to help CMOs find innovative ways to cut through. That's my strategy, right? But the tactic was interview them, write about them, and publish them, and make their brands look good. And a result of that was that they wanted to have conversations with me and Renegade.
Well, let's talk about the elements that you've selected. Are they... explain to the listeners what those elements are. I mean, obviously not all 64 will be expressed by you, but what's the general concept? How did you group them? And I wonder at least a few examples of some of the elements.
Sure. So I really tried to follow Dmitri Mendeleev, the genius 1869 Russian scientist who set up the periodic table. And it literally was from sort of lighter elements to heavier elements and things that it follows that if you look at the seven groups from basic elements, and I get to things like volatile factors. Well, you know, in the original periodic table, there were volatile elements, and so you know, I follow that all the way through in terms of a structure. But there, from a elemental standpoint, from a marketing standpoint, again, I think that way to think about it is there's basic things that you have to do in any job. And I start with the most fundamental element right away, which is setting expectations. You talk to anybody working for anybody, and what's amazing to me is how few people know what their boss expects of them, right? Mm-hmm. If you don't have that answer, you're going to fail. You don't even need to read the rest of the book. It's like, get those expectations set. Once you know what those expectations are, then you have an opportunity to exceed them, and you know, then you might actually have an ongoing customer. So you've got basic things on the left side, and then at the very far end, the last element, which is always innovating, to me is sort of a wonderful place to end the book and a great element to think about, in that this is something that, you know, the great marketers never stop innovating. And Beth Comstock spends 25% of her time out in the world talking to people, gathering information in order to sort of bring back to the mothership innovative thoughts or questions or things or new things that she can then work with her team to come up with the next, whether it's eco-imagination or health imagination. And they're just really, so if you start with, we're going to set expectations, and then the last element of always innovating. In between, you've got very tactical things like CRM and email and online optimization, and those are fairly sophisticated digital concepts. There are other things like, a lot of people have a question about how to do B2B content marketing or B2C content marketing. And I get into some really interesting and specific and sometimes unexpected uses of content marketing. And I could talk about one of those. One of my favorites is with Richard Marnell and Viking River Cruises. And, you know, most people think about content as a way of acquiring customers. And again, going back to my original premise, if you talk about what can you do for your customers, and maybe that could lead to acquisition. So it turned out for him, creating videos of cooking classes, of say for a trip that you were going to do in France, you do a French cooking class, that was a wonderful way of, for someone who had already signed up but was going to be taking a cruise a year from now, to maintain their excitement about it and for them to share it and say, hey, by the way, we're going on this cruise. Who wants to come with us? And so it became retention, acquisition through retention. It was very smart. So, you know, I think that, again, as we writers are always in the content business, but, you know, thinking about different ways of creating content, not just as a as an acquisition tool, but sometimes it's really just about helping your customers live their lives.
How do you distinguish between, how do you really identify is the core element and driver for all of this great ideas and great tactics and strategies you put together? How does the customer's wants and needs become the centerpiece of all of this? Because isn't that what matters really in the end of the day, is the centerpiece for the periodic table perhaps?
It's true, and I think you'd find that theme in almost all of the interviews that, you know, we spend a fair amount of time talking about their customers. But there's one element in the book called customer centricity, and I love this story. It's with Annie Metzen, who is at NEA Member Benefits, which is an organization that markets to teachers in their particular nonprofit organization. And she did an experiment where they used to send 50 different pieces of correspondence to every single one of their customers for all of the products that they offered. And she thought about customer centricity and said, I don't want 50 emails from anybody on anything. What if we try to reduce this down to something that would be a benefit? If we're talking to young teachers, we're just going to talk to them about, say, helping them with mortgages or something that they might be interested in, as opposed to life insurance, which they may not be interested for 20 years. And so she reduced her communications from 50 to 6, and the result of that was a 20% increase in sales. And so customer centricity has different meanings at different points, but that one in particular to me just reminded, sort of, it was a halo effect for the book, is that focus on your customer. And you're absolutely right. And so there's a lot of different ways of doing that. And I think part of the point is, depending on your situation, customer centricity may be creating content. Customer centricity may be doing less. It may be social customer service, like the folks at McDonald's do so well.
Hmm. What's the biggest pain point you repeatedly heard from CMOs regarding making marketing work well?
Well, there are a couple. First, and I tell you, I've come to admire the ones who are successful because their job is so hard. There's a reason why, you know, 3-year tenure is the average, and it's a lot less than the average CEO. And they're up against several obstacles. One, they often don't speak the same language of their boss, and that's a problem. The boss speaks in terms of top line and bottom line, and they speak in terms of brand. And those twains don't always meet. And secondly, they have a really hard time measuring things. You'd be amazed how difficult marketing, even with all the data that's available, to measure and pinpoint. And they all will say, I know I've got about 10% of my budget. I know I'm spending it a certain way, and I can't be certain what it is doing, but I'm going to keep doing it. And And that's not necessarily wrong, because not everything you do in marketing that enhances your brand is going to be measured. But I will say that one thing, that the biggest gap, and this is one, it's hard for a writer to think about it from a, you know, their standpoint, but brand health is everything. And so think about it from a writer's standpoint, it's reputation, right? Am I a person that someone wants to do business with on an ongoing basis? Well, that's the same thing for brands. And so the brands that are ultimately, and the CMOs that are ultimately more successful, are the ones that have brand health tracking and understand where their brand is. And I think, you know, we all sort of need to, as personal brands, need to have a sense of where our personal brands are and where our reputations are. And so that's... I think those are the two biggest challenges that that CMOs have.
I like asking this. When it comes to content marketing, I love asking this question. Where's all this great content going to come from? Right?
Well,
Are CMOs having a difficult time creating great content? Probably not themselves, but the team members they're hiring. How are they creating great content? Are they looking outside a corporation to do that these days? Do they feel that internal staff can be creative enough and engaging enough and tuned in enough with what's working, what isn't working, without being too close to the product? Tell us about that complexity. Where's all this great content going to come from?
You know, first of all, I love the fact that you say where all this great content is coming from, because in my opinion, most content isn't great. And what happened, and it happens in social and it happens in content, is you put together a content calendar, right? And you say, okay, we're going to publish 20 days out of 30 days, and then you have to feed the beast, and you're going to publish on Monday whether or not you have a great piece or not. And I think a lot of marketers fall into that trap. And the result is they're cranking out stuff. And if we go back to my earlier point about reputation, less is more. Better content, as you put it, great content. One great piece a week is worth five mediocre pieces. So having said that, marketers are really struggling to create great content. I mean, you need really good writers, and what their challenge is, it's very much of a cost benefit analysis, because they can crank out a blog post, right? 600 words, you pay somebody $200 or whatever it is, and you have this content. But if three people read it, for the most part, and nobody likes it and nobody shares it, it's hard to, you know, say, wow, that was worth the money, even though it only cost you a little bit. But I think the bigger risk for these brands is mediocre content dilutes the brand. And it says, well, they're not really a trusted source for me anymore. So going back to Richard Marnell, he produces really high quality videos, and they're a reflection of the experience you're going to have when you're going to go on the Viking River cruise. So if you create content that is below the perceived, you know, the value that you want people to think about your brand, then you're making a mistake. If you're a premium brand, you better have premium content. And so it's really hard for them, is the bottom line. It's particularly hard in video, which is increasingly important, because, you know, video storytelling is an art in and of itself, and very few brands have that capability in-house, although I've talked to a number recently who are trying, they're bringing in script writers from Hollywood, like IBM is doing that, and Georgia Pacific has hired a firm to help them with storytelling. So there's a great deal of interest, and I can tell you for certain that brands are going to be creating more content, not less, in the next 3 or 4 years. But the smart ones are getting better and better at judging what great is and how what it takes to get there.
Now, not everybody has the big budget to produce the big campaign that's the great content that we all want and need. Let's face it. I mean, there are 4 billion content assets produced every day. Okay. Isn't that staggering?
That's a big number.
That's a big number, right? But we can't just stop creating all this content. I mean, Google is an engine. We need to feed that engine if we want to maintain and grow our organic listing positions. So we're stuck right now. We're stuck in mud. We're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't. You know, the content marketing revolution requires we bang out a steady stream of content to feed the search engines, to feed our readers, to make sure that we care and that we're at least publishing something every day or every week or whatever our schedule happens to be. Don't you think that there is some importance with that consistency from the consumer's perspective? Don't you think that a consumer, even a B2B consumer, when they see a big void of a month because, you know, the marketing department was too busy doing other things to pay attention to the blog and like lost the sight of the ball, don't you think that's a flaw and that can hurt you in the long run?
I don't think so. So let me give you this scenario. If you get 5 emails every, let's say, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, 5 emails at 10 a.m. from the same company, and each of them has a mediocre piece of content, what's your perception of that brand going to be? Is it going to go down or is it going to go up? First of all, you're going to say, why are you bothering me with this every day? And why are you creating content that doesn't matter? Now, if you were going to say to me, I'm going to create great content with really, you know, some human truths and real character and insights that matter to me, not you, right? Because most content is created about the brand and not about the customer. It's so funny. If I write up for LinkedIn, the pieces that get the most help are ones that talk about not about just necessarily marketing. Often it's about life and, you know, getting more sleep or being, you know, just having a better work-life balance because it's about them, right?
Yeah.
And so I think the mistake is we think we have to fill this pipeline because otherwise they're going to forget us. No, they're going to forget you if you fill the pipeline with mediocre content.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yes, every brand needs to answer the 7 questions that, you know, that customers have about your product or service. You know, that's basic Content Marketing Institute 101 stuff, right? Answer the 7 questions about the pool guy and make sure you do that. And if you want to do it 5 different ways and get that posted on your blog so it's there and it does the search performance for you. But just cranking out, you know, fluff, I don't think gets brands anywhere. And I think it personally, and I've seen it, it pushes them backwards, not forwards.
And by the way, these are there's a big margin of a big gap here between, you know, garbage content that you're sort of referring to that's meaningless and has no value and super high-end content that's changed the world and changed your perception of life. I mean, okay, those are radical extremes, okay? So, you know, there's plenty of very good, helpful informational content being produced of the 4 billion assets, and I do believe that consistency is a good thing. But you and I can debate that forever. I think consistency is something that matters in life, you know, and my many TED Talks, and it's a wonderful TED Talk, as I recall, I think it's a TED Talk, but a guy that talks about the importance of making your bed every day. Like, this is his thing. Like, this is where life begins. He was in the military for many years, right? And people that don't have that discipline, one of the reasons they've continued that discipline of, like, the perfect bed be made is that sets the tone that you're capable, you're competent, you're ready to conquer anything because of that religious task that you do every day. So anyway, that's my case on consistency. If it's consistently great, even better. If it's consistently amazing, over the top, completely changed my insights, my perception of the world, fantastic. But you know what, Drew, neither you nor I can produce that every day or even every week or even every month. You know, these are hard, hard assets at the top of the scale to produce. Don't you agree with that?
I do agree that it's difficult to do great, but I would argue that a brand has to decide what the brand stands for.
Mm-hmm.
And if a brand, if you're American Express, you need to hit a very high standard, which is why they get professionals that have a reputation who are really good at this to do it. They, you know, they don't try to do it in-house because
right.
they're looking, right? I think
yep.
there's something, you know, what's interesting to me in the content revolution, what's going to happen is the cream keeps rising to the top.
Mm-hmm.
Seth Godin writes something, we know it's going to be good, we expect it's going to be good, we read it, right? Joe Schmo writes something, the only hope for it to get any kind of readership is that a Seth Godin or somebody else says, this is pretty good, right? And so somehow or other, the individual, the writer in this thing matters. And I think that as people think about, one of the chapters in the book is about personal branding. And I think writers have to think about the characteristics of their writing as a brand opportunity. And, you know, do they always start with a question? Are they always starting with a story? Do they bring something personal to it so that, you know, the reader gets to know the writer and says, I like this guy, right?
Right.
And I think what's absent from most writing, most blog posts, is personality and, you know, real sort of personalization where, you know, oh, this guy's coming. But basically, we end up falling in love with the writer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that I think is, again, it's missing in a lot of content. And so we, you know, our counsel to brands is whatever our standard is that we agree upon, there has to be a standard, and we're going to always meet or exceed that. And anything below that, we're not going to publish. And if that means four times a week instead of six, so be it.
What advice do you have for freelance writers, so many that are listening in and tuning into this? What advice do you have for them to take their career to the next level and tap into these bigger brands somehow with their expertise, with their passion, with whatever it is you're recommending them to do?
You know, I think there's a tremendous movement towards storytelling right now, and that understanding the conventions of story, whether it's plot lines and the human truths that often go into it, metaphors, and being able to frame articles as if you were writing, you know, a film script or a novel, it gives you a chance to sort of speak to that your storytelling capabilities, I think, is number one. Two is, if you are passionate about something, figure out a way to integrate that into your writing and so that you're bringing something more to the table than a nice, clean wiki post, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, often like that's what people want, right, as a writer. But if writers that get known because they have a point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, you know, what distinguishes, you know, a writer in demand versus just an everyday person is that you have a point of view and you express that point of view. Not everybody will like it, but and that's a really an important part of this is, you know, what you want to stir is a passion in your readers. And if you don't stir some passion in your readers, then you really, and even if, you know, I'm always happy when like someone was going, no, I disagree with you, Drew. Great. Great. And because, you know, I know that I'll get nine, that will stir up, you know, nine people to say, wow, well, I agree with Drew on this one. And you have a conversation. But I think most people just sort of play it safe. And that's, you know, that's playing it safe doesn't get you anywhere.
You know, to boost our listenership, I've been scolded for going on for many, many hours with podcasts like this. But I could seriously talk with you for a very long time about some of these issues. Just a couple final questions for you, and then we'll cut it short. When you think of the small to mid-sized business, you know, I get the fact that you work with big brands, you've interviewed big brands, the book is about big brands, but what differs in your mind between a big brand and a small business?
Well,
the way they approach,
you know,
marketing, obviously.
You know, I describe the entrepreneur as the CMO without a budget.
Mm-hmm.
So they have the same challenges, right? They have to figure out what their strategy is. Who are they talking to? They need, you know, just like a big brand, they need a strategy, and they need metrics that matter, making sure they know what they're measuring. They need a unique position, and they need the right mix of marketing elements. So the difference between the big and the small are just the sort of the dollar signs behind the budget. And when it comes to small businesses, I think the fundamental mistake that they make is trying to target everybody, because then you're, you know, basically you can't be all things to all people. Brand is about being very specific. We stand for this, for these people. And so I think focus is probably the mistake that small businesses make. Ironically, big businesses are better at it.
Yeah.
And except for the small businesses, you know, it's like we'll take anybody because they're, you know, whereas I've talked to a couple of small businesses only do one thing and they do it really well and their lives become so much easier because they get better and better and better at it. Mm-hmm. They know their customers better. And so I think, you know, focus. But in, you know, a little bit of renegade thinking goes a long way with a small business.
And what's the biggest mistake do you think a small business can make with regards to, you know, budget particularly? You know, do you feel like companies can really get in trouble if they spend too much money? Do you think experimentation needs to be mandatory at that stage, particularly with smaller budgets? You know, A/B testing, multivariate testing. Do you just have to be wiser? And what's your take on guerrilla bootstrapping with marketing and literally, you know, doing things that big brands would never imagine doing?
You know, I think that what happens with the smaller businesses is they spend way too much time executing and not enough time thinking about strategy. They just jump in. So that's the first thing, is more time and strategy. Know who's my customer, what does my brand stand for, who am I for, what am I against, and be pure, really stick to that. Then the second thing I would say is think about what your marketing could do for your customer, not what that could say. And by that I mean think about marketing as a service. So that's where content comes in, right? If I run a small business and I say am in the construction business and I help people build a second room to their house, right? If I provided all the content that would help someone understand every bit of the process there, then I've helped them. Then it's been a service to them, right? And I think if you think about service as your marketing, then you have a really good chance of succeeding. And there's so many different ways of doing it, and most of them are not that inexpensive, are not that expensive. So again, you have your strategy. What do I stand for? I'm purple and I do this for them and I want to help people to do this, right? And small, you know, I see a lot of brands trying to do well by doing good, and I think small businesses can particularly do that. I mean, the Kind Bar was a small business when it started, and Daniel Levitsky, the founder of Kind, went, you know, pretty much door to door and did kind acts to help get people excited about his brand. And you know, I think that's where small businesses have a chance, is focus on their niche and do it better than anybody else.
Really, really good point about thinking about service as part of your marketing. Are you seeing that CMOs these days view customer service as an integral and important part of the marketing play?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they you know, very few of them actually control customer service or customer experience, but all of them know their success is dependent on that. If you do a great marketing campaign and then the customer comes into the store and they have a lousy experience, you actually accelerate the decline of the business. So, you know, great marketing can kill a bad brand any day of the week. So the marketer knows, the CMO knows he has to go and be, you know, hold hands with a customer service team. He has to hold hands with experience team. And they have to agree that this is the level that we're going to try to achieve. Because these days, you know, brands are so public. And people, if they have a bad experience, they share it with 100, right? That's a critical aspect of this. And again, the great CMOs are the ones who can cajole and work. And even though they're not responsible, they can impact those areas.
Hmm. one of the some stats that you'll find interesting on this topic, 94% of B2B buyers undertake online research. 52% of buyers will remove a vendor from consideration if there is lack of post-sale content. Very interesting. 75% of customers prefer to use online self-service, and 10% of customers will remain loyal if they're not successful after 90 days. So some interesting stats there. What that is pushing us towards, even here at Writer Access, our company, is understanding that people are looking for online content to motivate them to buy, but also keep them educated about the product while they're in it. And there's some really interesting new technology being developed that is focused on that experience of like help desk on steroids, right? But doing that with video, doing that with in a more interesting way, making it easier to find explanations on how to do things. And frankly, all these SaaS models coming at us so fast are going to make it or break it, I think, based upon the content created about how their products work. Do you agree with that? And is that a trend you're seeing, that CMOs are starting to get that and wanting to control that? Because that's the critical element of referrals, don't you think?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's, the whole marketing automation revolution was the recognition that, most 70% of the customers do the homework before they ever call you, right?
Yeah.
And so that's where your points earlier about the importance of content, particularly the importance of good content, is front and center in that, yes, your online reputation precedes you. And so content is certainly one way of doing it. But I think the part that we haven't really touched on is that, that you need customers to create some good content for you, because, right? I mean, that's the thing. And then, that's where great content inspires customers to create and be involved with it, whereas, good content doesn't. And I think that sort of closes the loop in this conversation, is that, lots and lots of content is good. Lots and lots of great content is awesome.
Mm-hmm. Have you checked out Brian Solis, a book he wrote called X, The Experience When Business Meets Design?
I have it on my bookshelf.
Yeah. Amazing book. I'm a really big fan of his. I'm communicating him now on a couple of fronts. And super smart guy. But I think that this is the new intersection. This could be the next thing, even beyond what content marketing is right now. Experience when business meets design brings in customer service and how, for example, customer service is typically viewed as a cost center, right?
And correct.
That is completely the wrong approach, okay, according to Brian and many other people. It should be viewed as a revenue center, not a cost center. And it should be viewed probably as the most important revenue center of your company, because it's the experience that people have when they're using your product, drinking your product, whatever the case may be. But he triangulates, sales and marketing and customer experience and product design as a contiguous, revolving world where they all have to, jive with one another, connect with one another, and think about the journey, the customer journey, from before somebody even thinks about your product, or knows about it, to long after they've passed it by. It's a really interesting take on all of this. I'd encourage everybody to take a look at it. Really good stuff there. But anyway, back to you. I have two final questions for you. Like I said, I could go on all afternoon, Drew.
I love it.
Yeah, good stuff here. But two final questions. Who would you like to get a hold of you, and how can they get a hold of you?
So I talk to lots of people about lots of things. I'm always interested in talking to CMOs, either to help them tell this story or help them create a story. And that's sort of one of the interesting things, is if I meet a CMO and he doesn't have or she doesn't have a story to tell, I go, we ought to work together, because you should have one. So always looking for that. Medium-sized, big-sized, well-funded startups. You can find me at via renegade.com. My blog is the Drew blog. My book is cmobook.com. So lots of different ways. Feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn, as long as you send a note why. If you know, I hopefully folks know that not to do blind connect requests on LinkedIn.
Good stuff there, and words of wisdom as we cast out the door here. We got a lot of wisdom from you today, Drew. Thank you very much for being here.
Hey, my pleasure, and good luck to all those writers out there.
Right on. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. We'll see you next week on the Writer Podcast. Thanks for tuning in.
Thanks for listening, and happy writing. You can join us each week for a new podcast. Check out Writer Podcasts on Stitcher, iTunes, and our website, writeraccess.com.